Okay, organelles. What are you doing here? Why are you doing this to me? No, I don't want that. What in the hell is going on here? There you go. Okay. So we talked about ribosomes a bit, and we talked about the endoplasmic reticulum, and we please remember that we talked about the nucleus and that there is a sharing of fluid between that runs in the endoplasmic reticulum as compared to also around the nucleus. We also talked about how the nuclear envelope is continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum, and it all has to do with protein synthesis, and we'll be getting to that hopefully today. So we're going to talk about the Golgi apparatus. But first, I'm going to have you think about something. So we're going to make a pair of running shoes. You're going to go, what the hell does it got to do with anything, right? Okay, so we want to make running shoes. So right from the very beginning, what do we have to do to make running shoes? What's the first thing? Yeah, design it, right? Design it, okay? So once we design our shoes, pink, purple, metallic, whatever. Then what do we have to do once we've designed it? Not yet. Might need a waffle iron. What do we have to do? We've designed the shoe. Now what do we need to do? Yeah. What are we going to make it with? Right. You need materials. You got to get materials, right? So you figure out what the shoe's going to look like. It's going to have so much leather, so much rubber for waffle irons, glue to put it together, some metal for the eyes on the shoes, yada, 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 yada. Okay? So we get all that. Now what do we have to do? Assemble it. Put it all together, which results in the shoes. Okay? So the shoes are done. What happens next? No. Forget the marketing. Don't worry about that part. So we've made the shoes. They've gone down the line. We got a pair of shoes. What do you do with it now? Oh, sorry? Oh, forget all the testing stuff. We're okay. We've tested them. We're good to go. In the R&D part, we decided they worked really well. We made the shoe. What do you do next? Not yet. Because where are shoes usually made? Right. So the first thing with the brand new shoes, we have to put them in a box. And the box goes in a crate. And the crate goes in a skid. And the skid goes in a... And the truck goes in a, well, actually, because we think our shoes are made actually in a boat, right? Because most of the shoes are made in, Pacific Rim countries. I'll just put it that way. So they go in the boat, and they get delivered, and they go to the store, and we sell them and do whatever, okay? When we look at the creation of proteins in the relationship between the nucleus and the ribosomes in the rough endoplasmic reticulum, when we make a protein, which we'll be talking about shortly, we make a string of connected amino acids. So picture 1,000 little tiny balls with a little connection between all of them, going as far away and long as you possibly can. That is not a protein. It can become a protein, but what has to happen? It has to be folded. So strings of amino acids needed to be folded into very diverse three-dimensional shapes. Once that string of amino acids is folded into the appropriate shape, then it becomes a viable protein. So if we think of the shoes, we said that the nucleus has the recipe of what stuff we need to put together to come up with the particular protein we need to make. So then we make the protein, but it has to be folded and packaged to ship out of the cell to maybe go somewhere entirely further away in the body. So put the shoes in the box, in the skid, on the boat, and away it goes. Same thing with proteins. They get folded, created, and packaged in the Golgi apparatus. And in some cases, they stay within the cell because they're a viable protein. But quite often, they become a vesicle in the cell and then are ejected out of the cell through exocytosis, packaged, in order to travel in the bloodstream to go wherever it's needed, wherever it was asked for. Does everybody follow? Okay? So it's no different than making the pair of shoes. You got to figure out what you're going to make it out of, put it all together, package it, ship it, and so on and so forth. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I did. I did. So, the Golgi apparatus, if we look here at the diagram, you'll quite often see that the nucleus, the endoplasmic reticulum, and the Golgi apparatus are usually kind of within the same picture because of the relationship of what it does. So, it's an extensive organelle. It's usually comprised of several flattened sacs called cisterns. They're layered one upon another. They look like a stack of pitas. Think of it like that. It works very closely with the ER, and there are two faces. I know, leave it. Leave it. Leave it. We're past. No, I mean, for now. We got to get stuff done. So, you have two faces. You have a face that faces the endoplasmic reticulum, where all the ribosomes are that do what? Make proteins, right. So we have to package and fold those strings of amino acids in the Golgi apparatus. So there's two faces. There's one face that faces the endoplasmic reticulum that accepts the created, what's called polypeptide. So you have all these amino acids stuck together, okay? It accepts it, and then as this string of amino acids passes through the Golgi apparatus, all the stuff gets done to it, packaged, put in a box, yada, yada, yada. That face that faces the endoplasmic reticulum is called the cis face, C-I-S, the cis face. And not that it's of concern to us because it's a bit more in depth, but there we know scientifically the exact foldings that have to happen. Literally like making origami. So the body literally folds very specific proteins, very specific ways to become a viable protein. And that all happens here. So the cis face faces the endoplasmic reticulum that accepts the amino acids, the polypeptides that have been created by the ribosomes to do its thing. Then as it travels through, it gets worked, and then it leaves the Golgi apparatus via the transface. Okay, now the transface faces the membrane of the cell. So you have a face that faces the endoplasmic reticulum that accepts the created peptide bonds, and then it gets worked, and then it exits out the transface. In some cases, of course, that protein stays in the cell to be utilized by the cell internally, or it gets where it actually travels into secretory vesicles to leave the cell. Yes?
But they're not actually connected to each other.
No, they're spaced apart from each other.
Right?
Yeah, and it travels across. So a prime example is when you get a cold, what do you produce in your nose?
Mucus.
Right, proteins. Mucin is a protein. So that mucus that you're producing in your nose, think of how much you can produce when you're unwell. It's an inflammatory reaction. You have cells in your mucous membranes that are between the nucleus, the endoplasmic reticulum, and the Golgi apparatus are producing snot at an unbelievable rate and secreting it out of the cell, which we then go, oh my God, I got to blow my nose. That's a prime example of secreting outside the cell. Obviously, the whole purpose for mucus is to try to trap the virus so you blow it out or swallow it down into the gut, which the gastric juices will kill and so forth. What's that? Sir?
I was just saying that's probably why kids prefer that over broccoli.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. So and there's many other proteins that get created that do exactly the same thing. But there's even protein in the oils in your face and in the sweat out of your sweat glands and so forth, right? So amongst other things. So just picture that when we break it down to one cell, one nucleus, one endoplasmic reticulum, one Golgi apparatus, the reality is, your body can produce vast amounts of any particular protein it requires at any given time, okay? Remembering that, proteins can be enzymes, right? They can be building blocks. They can be part of your immune response when you get a virus of some kind or other. So they play major roles in the body, okay? And it's all via these two structures working together. So remember I said the nucleus has, it's the joy of cooking. It's the recipe book that has the pages with all the recipes, right? And then those recipes tell certain other parts of what amino acids to put together to create the particular protein. Then it travels into the cis face. It gets, again, three-dimensionally folded, packaged, so on and so forth. exit the transphase in these secretory vesicles, and you can see these little proteins, right? They're getting to the cell membrane, and they are then excreted through exocytosis into interstitial fluids or bloodstream or whatever it's needed for, okay? All right. Compounds produced in the endoplasmic reticulum are transported to the Golgi apparatus by way of endoplasmic transport vesicles, and once at the Golgi apparatus, they meld into the organelle. And once they enter the Golgi apparatus, they're processed, packaged as they pass from one cisternae to the next. So that picture that, you know, everybody's got, you know, just like an assembly line with the running shoes, right? Somebody's putting the shoes together, somebody's doing whatever, until eventually at the very end, it's in a box with some frilly little tissue paper and so on and so forth. They are then released as secretory vesicles or sometimes lysosomes. So remember that proteins can also act as digestive parts and be very, very good at breaking things down because, again, they're enzymes, right? Proteins can be enzymes. So sometimes they go into these lysosomes. Secretory vesicles transport compounds to the cell membrane and then release them into the extracellular fluid. Of course, the lysosomes are within the cell and they've got their own role. We'll be talking about those in a moment. The Golgi apparatus also transports lipid and protein molecules, which are transported to the cell membrane to maintain that membrane. Because remember, the membrane is made up of proteins and lipids. So therefore, that's where all these specialty lipids and so forth are made and maintains the cell membrane. Okay? The structure is found in most cells, but especially secretory type cells like the mucous membranes. And in fact, the cells that are in the mucous membranes are called goblet cells. I always remember goblet as gob. We used to use that term as kids when I was in elementary school. If you spit, it was a gob. That's just the way I remembered it, right? So goblet cells actually produce this mucus, and they use a protein called mucin in order to do so. So you have this protein, and you have water, and that's what represents mucus. So you can see it here in this diagram as well. We can see the vesicles heading into the cyst face and then leaving the trans face to either become a vesicle within, like a lysosome, or to be excreted out by the cell itself. So these lysosomes, they have a membrane. Then they have to have a membrane. They contain over 40 different hydrolytic enzymes, which are proteins. Okay? Oh, is he up to 60 now? Okay. Yeah, still over 40, yeah. I would never ask a question on that. Anyways, I don't really care about that, but just understand that there are, you know, when the reason I kind of put that in is to give you the sense of the diversity of proteins that actually any cell can create. There's lots of proteins, okay, that have all different roles. The membrane is crucial because it prevents the release of what's in the enzyme or in the lysosome. So what's in the lysosome is actually deadly to the cell because the lysosome's responsibility is think of it as the digestive system for the cell. So it'll if something comes into a cell, it'll sort of wiggle up to whatever's in there and then release its enzymes and break something down. If it's like a bacterial infection or a virus, the enzymes in the lysosome can actually break that virus down. Now, what's really cool about that is the virus is made of proteins and other things. It breaks down the virus so that it's longer viable, but it damn sure uses those amino acids that it used when it broke it down because it's still workable. So it just think of it breaks it down and then uses it for itself. Yeah, at the same time. So there are times when a lysosome does or is influenced to release its enzymes into the cell itself. When that happens, that is known as autolysis, right? So there is controlled autolysis. For example, when a female is postpartum and is no longer breastfeeding, autolysis breaks down those mammary cells that were producing milk at the time and then are no longer required, so the mammary glands regress back to prenatal function, which is not a whole lot, really, because they're not producing milk anymore. So, but that is through autolysis that it happens. The loss of the webbed areas of toes and fingers. So when you're inside mom developing, those webs are pretty extensive in the digits and in the toes. They're quite high. They involve a lot of the fingers. It has to do with the modeling that happens. So then autolysis gets stimulated, and all the web gets dissolved back to where it is. of course, sometimes that doesn't work so well, and some individuals do have webbed toes or webbed fingers, and if it's significant enough, they may have to surgically, when they're very young, just snip them a little bit. And, anybody here tongue-tied? Were you ever tongue-tied? I was tongue-tied. You know, a little frenulum under your tongue? Mine was quite large, and mine didn't regress back. So in the doctor's office back then, because we're talking the 50s, the doctor just lifted up my tongue with no freezing and went, there's a little baby, and cut the tie off. Oh, this is interesting. Twilight Zone, you guys wouldn't know what Twilight Zone is. Most of you guys wouldn't know what Twilight Zone is. See the clock? Yes. Yeah. No, it destroys the cells. So if you have cells, it's almost like a bit of a controlled suicide. Yeah, that's a bit different than this. No, this is the use. This is the use. Lysis. Yeah, autolysis is auto, like it's like self. It's destruction of self.
Okay, but self.
It uses proteolytic enzymes to basically dissolve everything in the cytoplasm. No, you have to be careful with that, because if you use destruction, there's many other things that do destruct cells.
Okay.
This is a very controlled, like a switch gets flicked, that this cell is about to die. It's about to kill itself. Yeah. But don't get stuck just in destruction, because there's many other ways a cell can be destructed. This is a cell's decision to kill itself, basically, right? And remove itself because it's no longer required in there. Such as again, post-lactation, the mature mammary glands regress back to prenatal.
And it just goes in and destroys whatever. Goes
no, it destroys from within. Nothing goes in. So the lysosomes in the cell that have the membrane, that membrane disappears, and those proteolytic enzymes just eat everything in the cell. Nucleus, endoplasmic reticulum, everything. So it disappears. What's that?
Membrane
disappears, organelles disappears, they all get dissolved, if you want to use that term. It's gone. Yeah. Yep. So that's why in a normal function cell, we want a membrane around the lysosome, because what is within the lysosome can actually kill the cell. Oh, yeah. So let's say you have a macrophage and you have a bacterial infection. So a macrophage will send out those pseudopods and surround that bacterium, okay? Now that bacterium is in a vesicle inside the cell. The lysosome will sneak up and snuggle up to that vesicle and release its proteolytic enzymes and dissolve that entire bacterium. Yep, only that bacteria within the vesicle, and then reabsorbs it all back in. That's just one sort of example of what a lysosome can do. So we can say then lysosomes primarily function in cell digestion and sometimes defense. And as I said, it's done by the lysosome binding to a phagocytic or a pinocytic vesicle. Remember, phagocytic is kind of solids and pinocytic is kind of liquids. The lysosome binds and releases its enzymes which digest the contents, whether it's food or foreign organisms. They also help digest non-functional organelles. So when an organelle kind of getting old and not functioning well, the lysosome will break that non-functioning organelle up again using the parts of that dysfunctional organelle to create something else, amino acids and so forth. If the organelle gets destroyed because it no longer is functioning, this is known as autophagy. Okay, autolysis is the complete destruction of the cell. Autophagy is just the destruction of an identified organelle that's kind of old, not functioning well, that kind of stuff. Once the contents have been digested, usable byproducts diffuse through the lysosomal membrane and into the cytosol to be used to create something entirely different. An amino acid is an amino acid. The cell doesn't care. But once you've broken down the invader or whatever it is, it will utilize those things of whatever it's destroyed or dissolved or broken down for the cell to use to create something else down the line. Yeah, in autophagy it is. In autolysis it's not. It's completely destroyed. But then in this case, you're just destroying a particular organelle, which then would be replaced by another one. You have to understand that, for example, nerve cells. How long do nerve cells live? Sorry?
Like they don't come back, so they live for as long as you.
Right. So you create them inside mom, and they're yours for life. And they can never be replaced. Okay? So you can imagine organelles in there get old, don't function well, have to be replaced, for example. No, because that's the destruction of the nerve itself. This is the cell still, this is the nerve cell still functioning okay. It's just kind of cleaning up the household while it's working. Okay. In autolysis it would, but not in the nerve cell. No. Lysosomes, the waste that remains in the lysosome, so obviously through the membrane of the lysosome, those things that can be used by the cell leave that membrane and the cell uses them. The leftover yucky stuff, the lysosome will go up to the membrane and through exocytosis will release the junk for that to be used by the body. So you'll hear me say quite often how, you know, metabolic byproducts of cells have to be, you know, they get taken up by the liver or the kidneys or whatever's happening, right? Because every chemical reaction that occurs in the cell has, in some cases, toxins or unwanted byproducts and so on and so forth. They're found in every cell, and they're produced by the Golgi apparatus. Now, a cell inside has a neutral pH of about 7, and the lysosome has a pH of around 5. There are hydrogen pumps in the lysosome membrane that is constantly pumping hydrogen into the lysosome, which helps with these proteolytic enzymes to break things down. Think of it as the inside of the lysosome is acidic, if you want to use that term. As you can see, you got the single wall membrane around it and then these enzyme complexes that sit within. Peroxisome is somewhat similar, except they're not formed by the Golgi apparatus. They're formed by the endoplasmic reticulum, smooth, and they contain different kinds of enzymes known as oxidase. So the lysosome had proteolytic enzymes. The peroxisome has oxidase. And what happens is, they all come together to form hydrogen peroxide within the peroxisome. So you have proteolytic enzymes in the lysosome, and you have hydrogen peroxide in the peroxisomes. Okay? What does hydrogen peroxide do? It's an oxidizing compound, which means that it removes oxygen atoms from organic compounds. Many things have oxygen as part of their makeup. And so what this does is remove the oxygen, and therefore those things that bind things together to make compounds disappear, and it can no longer be the compound because the oxygen's been removed. Okay? This is why you should not use hydrogen peroxide on wounds and cuts, because that oxidation will also destroy perfectly viable cells at the same time. Although to this day, I will still use hydrogen peroxide for a cat scratch. I don't know what it is. It just takes that burn away from a cat scratch better than anything. But I don't use it for anything else. Possibly, yeah.
I'm not sure. But yeah, well, you're not supposed to vomit on the way up. But like with solid things.
Yeah.
Like within so long.
Yeah. Back when I went to school, there was this movement that to snort hydrogen peroxide if you had like a head cold, because it would destroy the virus. So I tried it once. I figured, what the hell? Give it a try. Got a little spoonful. Did the snort. Wasn't good. Snapped my head back pretty hard. No, I don't believe so. Hey, but you have to experiment, right? What the hell? Oxidation is especially useful in breaking down fatty acids into acetyl coenzyme A, which is used by the mitochondria to produce energy so the cell can carry out its functions. So oxidation does work, and we're going to be spending a little bit of time in acetyl coenzyme A when we're talking about the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chain. Proteasomes are very interesting. There's continuous destruction of unneeded, damaged, or faulty proteins. So even when the nucleus creates, or through a nucleus and the relationship with the ribosomes, still sometimes create buggered up proteins and that don't function properly. So what do we do with those? Well, we don't want to waste amino acids, so we have to take that screwy protein and we want to break it down to reuse the amino acids. This is where proteasomes come in. They contain proteases that slice proteins into small peptides, and then other enzymes continue breaking down those peptides into finally into the amino acids, which then can be utilized at any given time. So everybody knows about proteins, right? How are amino acids? How many are there? Anybody know? Not quite. That's a bit too much. 24. 12 of them are essential and 12 are non-essential, which means 12 of them the body makes, but 12 of them you have to eat. So you can see that, you know, from a recycling perspective, the body wants to hang on to amino acids whenever it can. So these proteasomes are really cool. They actually take proteins. This is a protein of interest, and it'll go through this proteasome, and it's literally like a slicing machine, and it breaks these peptide bonds. So instead of having 1,000 amino acids all stuck together, it chops them up into more workable parts. And then enzymes will continue breaking down those peptide bonds, and then those loose floating amino acids will get used to create other proteins down the road by the ribosomes and so forth. Okay? Or RNA, I should say. Mitochondria. This is known as the powerhouse of the cell because it creates a compound called adenosine triphosphate, which of course is the fuel that runs just about everything in your body. And when we get to aerobic anaerobic metabolism, we'll spend a lot more time on the mitochondria. Okay. So, as I was talking about proteins, and I've sort of alluded to this a few times. Let's talk about kind of the last one here is the nucleus. And, you know, you'll hear things like it's the brain of the cell and so forth. So it is the control center or brain of a cell. And it regulates cell function by controlling protein synthesis. Everything's about proteins. Okay? Remember, enzymes are proteins, and enzymes regulate chemical reactions in the cell. We need them. The body is always creating various kinds of proteins, very much so enzymes, which really do have an influence on chemical reactions that occur within the cell. It also controls cellular division. So when a cell decides to divide, it is the nucleus that said, hey, we need to divide. Most cells have one nucleus, but some, like your cardiac muscle cells and skeletal muscles, have many. So we find two in the cardiac cells, and we find many in skeletal muscle cells. Remember, structure governs function. So if we have a couple more nucleuses, that means that cell must be creating vast amounts of proteins, right? Although many cells have their nucleus at the center of the cell, some don't. So we'll find that skeletal muscle cells keep their nuclei on the periphery. Why might you think that? Why would we not have the nucleus in the middle of a skeletal muscle cell, but have it on the outside by the membrane? Because when a muscle cell contracts, it shortens. So we wouldn't want a nucleus getting crushed in the movement of a muscle cell. So by maintaining the nucleus on the outer edge, it's less likely to get any damage as the muscle cell is doing its thing and contracting and getting elongated. There are three main components to the nucleus. First is the nuclear envelope. We've talked a little bit about it because we know that it's associated with the endoplasmic reticulum. It is a double lipid bilayer, very similar to the cell's membrane itself. Now, it has pores or channels like the cell membrane, but these channels, they call them pores because they're 10 times larger than an integral protein pore, okay? They're huge from a microscopic perspective, these big, big pores. These are pores that are associated with the nucleus and the nuclear envelope, okay? Yes, they're for there. Now,
The reason they're so large, because they need RNA to pass. I'll just jump ahead a little bit and say that although the nucleus does contain the recipes for proteins within the genetic material that we find in the cell nucleus, that genetic material never leaves that nucleus. Okay? The recipe's in a book, or if you want to call it The Joy of Cooking, it's in there, but it never comes out. And kind of the main purpose of that is we wouldn't want genetic material floating around in a cell because of the potential for it getting bumped and broken and altered, and then creating mutated proteins would increase the problem. So we keep genetic material inside the cell, but somehow we have to get the recipe for the protein out of the cell or the nucleus and out into the cell where it gets created, and we'll talk a whole lot about that. What's involved in that is ribonucleic acids. So that RNA is a very large molecule, which is taking the photocopy of the recipe, and we need these large pores in order for the RNA to leave the cell or the nucleus. As we said, the outer membrane is continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum, and the space in the nuclear envelope is continuous with the endoplasmic reticulum cavity. This interconnection, of course, is important because if the nucleus has the recipes to make proteins and the ribosomes on the endoplasmic reticulum make proteins, we want a great connection between those two viable organelles in order to work together. So we can see here's our ribosomes here on the endoplasmic reticulum, or even the cell membrane, the nuclear envelope itself, and we can see these very large pores which allows this RNA to exit at any given time. Next, we find in here deoxyribonucleic acid and ribonucleic acid, and these are known as nucleic acids, and the reason they're called nucleic acids is because they were first discovered in the nucleus, so therefore its name kind of denotes the fact that these compounds are found within the nucleus itself. The bulk of the nucleus, though, is DNA, which we all know is the code of life, okay? DNA is the molecule which contains the code of life. Each DNA molecule contains thousands of genes. So what's a gene? You've probably heard that term before, right? You heard in biology class in high school or whatever. What is a gene? They're segments of DNA which code for particular proteins. I want you to start thinking of DNA material like spaghetti. And the bowl, no sauce, just the spaghetti in a bowl. Think of every strand of spaghetti is a DNA molecule. Okay? Imagine how much spaghetti you can have in a big bowl. And they're all long. And then sections of that spaghetti are genes. And genes code for particular proteins. Everybody follow me? Right? Okay? So you got the spaghetti. You got these little pieces of spaghetti, intact spaghetti, and certain parts of that spaghetti are responsible for certain proteins, whatever they may be. So genes are segments of DNA which code for particular proteins, and as a result, control the function and makeup of the cell and ultimately the entire organism. Now, those genes and that bowl of spaghetti is the same bowl of spaghetti that's in every single cell in your body. So every single cell has the same spaghetti and the same gene segments or DNA segments in every cell in your body. And where did they come from? Half from mom and half from dad, which then made you. Now, within that, of course, you carry genes that are very similar to running down genetic lines, right? Certain shapes or colors or so on and so forth, they actually run within it. So, but ultimately, that bowl of spaghetti, half of it was mom, half of it was dad, and it all came together. Okay? Yeah, that's right. So you can see here, we're going to be talking a whole lot about this. DNA is this double configuration that we see here, and RNA is singular. And we will be spending time on it, but we do find some RNA in the nucleus. We need to, but the majority of the nucleus is DNA, which contains these genes. So when the cell is in its non-dividing stage, the DNA molecules are loosely formed and are known as chromatin. So when the DNA material is like the spaghetti, that spaghetti is known as chromatin, right? Everything's kind of laying around loose within the nucleus itself. During division, though,
We have to do something with that genetic material, that spaghetti, because ultimately it's you know, hard to kind of package when it's all loose like that. And you know, when the cell divides, the nuclear envelope around the nucleus, it dissolves, and we don't want all this free spaghetti floating all over the cell. So we have these little things called histones. And what they do is they come along and they curl the DNA up and make it packageable. Okay, so we say, during cell division, the DNA molecule will condense upon itself with the aid of many protein molecules known as histones. And when they form that squiggly little package, they look like what you've learned about is chromosomes, you know, the X's and all the little size different X's, right? Well, it's the histones that took the spaghetti and rolled it all up into those packages that we call chromosomes. Yeah, that's right. Okay? So, I mean, you go from this, right, you know, all over the place here, and the histones do this. Right? So you end up, instead of loose spaghetti, you end up with these chromosomes. And the histones are these proteins that come along and fold up all that DNA material to make it workable. Because when the cell divides, again, we don't want spaghetti floating around. We want to be able to control the package and keep it condensed. So, you know, we don't want to bump it and do damage to it, because then, of course, that leads to mutated proteins. And that's kind of what cancer is mutated proteins. It's one of the things that happens with cancer is you start getting weird proteins created. Under normal circumstances, you make weird proteins all the time, but your body recognizes them and kills them. But for some reason in cancer, something we still haven't quite fully figured out yet, those weird proteins, those mutated proteins, they get ignored and they continue to grow and divide and create these proteins that, you know, if it's a tumor or cancer, those sorts of things. So it's one of the things that it's going to be very difficult. There likely will never be a cure for cancer. Yeah, no, but there's too much diversity in it. There's a really good book out there. What the heck's his name? He's Indian. He wrote a book on cancer. It's a very, very good book. You've almost got the title. It's called The Cure for... I'll get it. I'll figure it out. But it's a very good book to read. So these chromosomes, these X's, normally each cell has a complement of 46 chromosomes. 23 homologous pairs. Homologous means that half came from mom and half came from dad. Okay? So every single cell in your body that's a functioning cell has 23 pairs of chromosomes. All right? Every single cell in your body. Oh, well, except for your gonads. Right? So your ovum in females and sperm in males, they don't. They have half. That's why when mom and dad come together, half genetic material from mom, half genetic material from dad, they come together and therefore you get a fully formed cell and starts to divide and away you go and get a little baby. Okay? Oh, we'll get there. That's a way larger question to answer. Okay? So, normally you have 23 homologous pairs. Now, I know gender is fluid in our world today and, you know, there's a lot of conversation of what defines male, female, gender, and so forth. Scientifically, what's known is that when we look at chromosomes, they are numbered 1 to 22, and the last pair are considered sex chromosomes, being X and Y. So when we look at these chromosomes, we can determine, traditionally, male versus female by this last pair of chromosomes. X and Y is what? And X and X is? Right. Okay? So that's the traditional sense of it. Can there be individuals with extra chromosomes? Yes. Or XXYs? Or XYYs? Yes, there is, right? So we know that now, and that's what leads to many variations. But, and I'm not going to spend any time on this, but, you know, the definition of gender is quite interesting right now, because scientifically is one thing, but how a person feels and what happens is something entirely different, right? So this is why, you know, this is a topic of conversation extensively because of what really defines gender. There's tons of books and lectures and all kinds of stuff on it. So, yes.
I have a friend who's got Klinefelter's syndrome.
Yeah, there's no balance between the two. You need them both. So, but in the traditional sense, this sort of represents it. The X-shaped chromosome is actually called a mitotic chromosome because it actually contains two molecules of DNA referred to as chromatids, which are joined in the mid. So when we look at these chromosomes, when we see this kind of configuration, we know a cell is going to divide. And when the cell divides, this genetic material goes to that cell, and this genetic material goes to that cell, and then we have viable cells. And we'll get into what mitosis is a little bit later, but just understanding this is what we find in the nucleus is this DNA material. So we can see here on the right, you can see the DNA as chromatin, this double helix formation, the spaghetti. But then when the cell wants to divide, you can see these histones come into play, and they wrap all this genetic material up, and you end up with this, you know, curly kind of X configuration, which represents the more condensed version of DNA that's getting ready to divide. The reason we say there are 22 homologous pairs is because 1A comes from mom and 1B comes from dad and so on. And I say the final pair determine if the organism will be male XY or female XX. Now, the one thing we do have to understand about that, right, wrong, or different, XX and XY stimulates hormonal release. So whether it's a penis and testicles or an ovary and a vagina and a uterus, what are they inside mom initially? Everybody's a female. And then eventually, under the influence of hormones, things alter or change to either become, you know, penis and testicles or fully functional female genitalia, or depending on what it is. So something like that where you have a situation where or those sex hormones are altered in any particular way, that's why you end up with hermaphrodites, or you end up with many other diseases that can occur. Okay, but ultimately, the fetus, so here's the question. Actually, one of my, Ian actually bought me a book once that said, the title of the book was called Why Do Men Have Nipples? Yeah. Why? Why would a male have a nipple? Structure governs function. Does a male need nipples? No, but the model of creation, right, until that certain point, and that fetus will go one way or the other, depending, these are still part of the model, even though they will not be functional in a male. Stacey, I'm not sure like me, when I was a teenager, I was 17 years old, I started lactating. Yeah. And what it was is during puberty, when hormones are going like this, I had a period of short period of time where I had far more estrogen than I did testosterone, and I started lactating. As a 17-year-old boy, that's kind of like, yeah. But again, it's just hormones. It's just what happens, right? Oh, I can't remember what week it is. It's somewhat early. Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know well enough to exactly when that point is, but there is a point in development where the decision is made via hormone production. Because the first thing that has to happen, those structures that create those hormones, they need to mature and start functionally creating the hormones before everything else starts to happen. Well, part of the problem with gender assignment surgery is that it's quite simple to remove and create a vagina, but it's not simple to take a vagina and create a penis. We haven't come to that yet. We don't know how to do that, right? So that's where the problem lies. You can do all the hormones you want. I've had patients in the hospital setting. I had one patient in particular. He, I'd use the wrong pronoun, came in at 25 years old and had a heart attack. And we couldn't figure out why he would refuse to remove his underwear, because when you have a heart attack and you go into the ICU, you have to be catheted because you're not allowed to leave the bed. And it turned out the reason why is because he still had female genitalia, although he was identifying as male, and he really didn't want the hospital to know that. The reason he had a heart attack at 25 years old was because of the hormones he was taking to try to assign into a male. And that estrogen, progesterone, testosterone balance, it led him to again, collecting too much fats and lipids in the blood and resulted in, again, him having a heart attack at 25 years old. What was disturbing about that whole situation is the way the physicians treated him. It was not appropriate. I thought it was pretty bad. One of the doctors actually suggested to call him an it. Yeah. Very. Very. Anyway, so DNA, chromosomes, segments, genes create proteins. RNA is the second type of nucleic acid. Now, RNA relays instructions from the genes to guide the cell's synthesis of proteins from amino acids. So DNA is the genetic material with the genes, with the recipes of what protein to make. RNA is the functional compound that makes proteins. So there are a number of different types of RNA, and their whole responsibility is to read the recipe and then have all the parts ready to go to create the polypeptide bonds, which eventually become the viable proteins that we require. Okay? So there you go. You can see this, you know, at any given time. I don't profess to know that much about chromosomes, to be honest with you. I haven't taken a lot in it. I do know I watch Finding Your Roots. Anybody here watch Finding Your Roots on PBS? It's very good. It's a gentleman who is a professor in the U.S., and they do bring in stars, movie stars and musicians and so forth. And especially if they have very interesting backgrounds, they basically do genealogy, looking at papers and so on and so forth. But at some point in the show, they actually use DNA to go way back, and they can actually determine many things just by looking at the genetic material of the individual. They can actually come to, for example, they might go 7 generations back and have a common ancestor as things split out genetically and had a look at it. It's kind of a neat show. Try it one day. It's kind of neat. Finding Your Roots. So DNA is a chain of repeating monomers called nucleotides. And each nucleotide consists of 3 parts. The first is what's called a nitrogenous base. And there are 4 of them in DNA. Adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. That's it. 4. Okay? So we'll put those in. So we've got A. I told you guys, I did look for a whiteboard because I absolutely hate chalkboards. So you can barely see anything. I want green and I want blue. There we go. A, G, T, and C. Okay? So those are your nitrogenous bases. The next thing is that there is a 5-carbon sugar called deoxyribose, which attaches to each base in DNA. Now, it is a sugar, but it is not a sweet sugar. It has to do with the way the makeup is of this particular sugar, but it is a pentose, which means it's 5-sided. Okay? And then the last thing we have is a phosphate group. And this alternates between the pentose sugars to form the backbone of the DNA strand. So we can see here is your monomer, here your A, G, T, and C, and then you can see in red is your pentose sugars. So we can kind of draw 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, we've got our pentose sugars, and then we have our phosphate group. And we can see our phosphate group here. So it's here, 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 and so forth that bind them all together. Okay? All right. This is more the traditional way when we see the double helix that we can see here, that they're all sort of lined up to each other. Now, in 1953, now this may seem, 1953 may seem like a long time away for you. It's not. It's actually, from a scientific perspective, it's very, very early. And they hypothesized this whole thing in 53. They weren't sure if they were right or not, but there's a little side story to this. Did the men figure out DNA, or was there a female involved? Absolutely.
I don't remember what.
I can't remember her name either. Absolutely.
She got like a Nobel Prize for it, I think.
She eventually did more recently. I can't remember
her
name. Yeah, because because again, she was female. She kind of got the boot because, you know, men are the scientists. And they used her research to do their thing. And that's recently come out in the last 10 years or so or something like that. Yeah, crazy, eh? What's that?
Rosalind Franklin.
Franklin, that's it, yeah, right. So, in 1953, Crick and Watson hypothesized the shape of the DNA based on a double-strand configuration, which we all now know as the double helix. So think of it as a rope ladder, right, that you kind of twist. The alternating phosphate groups and deoxyribose sugars make up the uprights of the ladder, and the nitrogen bases make up the rungs by pairing and bonded by hydrogen. So I'm going to remove the sugars because they really don't belong there. They kind of belong over here. But I'm not going to get too much into the phosphates and the sugars. But what's important for us is how they pair. Adenine always pairs with thymine, and cytosine always pairs with guanine. So that means this A, what would be over here? Be a T. What would be with the G? C, which is white. What would be with the T? And what would be with the C? Right. Okay? So no matter what, you always get that pairing. Okay? Always. And in between those, what pairs them is good old-fashioned hydrogen. Okay, holding it all together, right? So if we go back again to this, you've got your pentose sugars and your phosphate in these little circular parts here. These rungs represent the monomers, A, G, T, and C. And then in here, what you wouldn't see is a little hydrogen molecule that's holding it all together within that configuration. Okay? You can see it this way. Maybe this makes more sense to you. So here's your phosphate group, here's your pentose sugar, and here's your monomers with your hydrogen bond between the two. Again, always A to T, G to C. Always.
And these sugars are not
the same sugars that we're talking about, like the protein. No. Right. Everybody follow so far? Okay, so RNA, instead of a double strand, is a single strand. It's a single strand, and the sugar, instead of deoxyribose, is ribose. So it's a slightly different sugar. And instead of thymine, you now have a new compound. So this is DNA. In RNA, you have A, G, U, and C. Okay, it's slightly different. Right? So it says thymine is uracil, but the relationship is still the same. A to T, G to C. But instead in RNA, wherever there is a T, there is a U doing the same relationship. Yeah. Now there are three types of RNA. And remember I said DNA is the genetic material with all the genes to make proteins, right? RNA is all as the worker bees. RNA is required to create the protein. So DNA has the gene with the recipe. RNA is the working bees that brings everything together to create the protein from the recipe. Everybody follow me? Okay, so there are three types of RNA. Messenger RNA, also known as mRNA. Ribosomal RNA, also known as rRNA, and transfer RNA, also known as tRNA. Okay? Yes. Yes, and copies the recipe. But we'll get to that in a moment with protein synthesis. Oh, we're getting there. Okay, so we can see here, messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA. In both DNA and RNA, the genetic information is stored as a set of three nucleotides. So when we have three monomers together, whether it's an RNA or a DNA, so let's just take three here, one, two, three, this is known as a base triplet, also known as a codon. So any three is known as a codon, okay, or a base triplet. So in DNA and RNA, the genetic information is stored as three nucleotides. The sequence of three is called a base triplet, and it is this base triplet that's copied during protein synthesis. A copied base triplet is known as a codon, and the codon specifies for a particular amino acid. So that means that this T, C, and A, somebody give me an amino acid. One, anyone, I don't care what. Sorry, thymine. Yep, so that's the recipe. So those three, TCA, and that codon is representing one of the amino acids required to make the protein. Everybody follow me so far? Every three represents an amino acid, of which there are 24. Sorry. Yeah, so let's do a recipe. You want to make a loaf of bread. What do you need? Okay, a cup of flour. What else? Tablespoon of yeast. What else? Cup of water. Pinch of salt. Eggs. You're making challah. Yeah, but ultimately, you've got all these things. So the heading of the recipe says bread. So the body or the cell says, I need to make snot. I need mucin, this particular protein mucin, in order to create mucus, right? So within the context of a gene is every three bases equals a particular amino acid. And to make mucin, you might need three parts thymine, or they're all the different amino acids. No, these are amino acids. So the actual names of amino acids. So you'd have three parts of this one part of that one, two parts of this one, and they all come along in a string and get folded, and they create mucin, which then, of course, is secreted by the goblet cells, which gives us snot. Okay? Yes?
Okay. What does that have to do with
mRNA? Oh, we'll get to that. Don't you worry. That's ribonucleic acid. Oh, we're getting there. Don't you worry. Okay? So here we go. We can see here, ACG gives us threonine, and TEAC gives us tyrosine. So every tree represents an amino acid. So that must mean that in that recipe, we need threonine, tyrosine, and then the next one, and the next one, and the next one to make the particular protein we're after. Does everybody follow that? Sort of. When we get the protein synthesis, it will make a lot more sense. Now, the other thing we find in the nucleus is something called the nucleolus. So within the nucleus is the nucleolus. It is a spherical body. It's found within the nucleus, and it contains DNA, ribosomal RNA, and proteins. We had three RNAs, right? We had messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA. All three of these RNAs are created in the nucleolus. All right? All created in the nucleolus, also stored in the nucleolus for when they're required. It's also the site where immature ribosomes are formed before they enter the cytoplasm for final processing. So these ribosomes that are an integral part of creating protein, they're also created in the nucleolus as well. Some nuclei contain more than one nucleolus, and of course, when a nucleus or a cell is actively synthesizing proteins, the nucleus does enlarge because it's getting used to create a lot of these RNAs in order to create protein. I don't know whether or not to start at this or not. How many people here have taken protein synthesis? Anybody? Yeah. Have you taken a course or lectures on protein synthesis? All I can say is, it's really cool. let's get started on it. Might as well. We got 5 minutes, so let's get started on it. Oh, stupid thing. I know. We got a lot to do. Trust me. Yeah. Yeah, I'll do it after this. I'd forgotten about it. I'm glad you reminded me. So I'll do it. It just has to do with some of the cytoskeleton, that kind of stuff. So I do want to stay on this because we did the nucleus. So, yes. Oh, yes, please. All right. So we alluded to some of these things when we just finished the lecture on the nucleus. We talked about, we've got DNA, we've got genes. Every three base equals a particular amino acid, and that RNA is very much the workhorse of the creation of protein synthesis. So protein synthesis is the process by which quite a number of proteins are created. As we know, it's the type of proteins that determine the physical and chemical characteristics of cells and therefore the organism. When a gene's DNA is used to create a template for a protein, this is known as a gene expression. Okay. Now, where that's going to come back again is when we're talking about cancer. So we get particular gene expressions in certain cancers where certain proteins get created. So what is protein synthesis? In transcription, the information encoded in a specific region of DNA is copied to create a specific molecule of RNA. And in translation, that RNA that's the copy of the DNA attaches to a ribosome, where the information in the RNA is translated into a corresponding sequence of amino acids to form a new protein. Huh? Okay, so we've got spaghetti. Okay, we've got spaghetti. And we know that pieces of spaghetti represent a gene. And a gene is the recipe for particular proteins. We can make that into a cookbook and say, one piece of spaghetti makes you meatballs, one piece of spaghetti makes you tomato sauce, one piece of spaghetti tells you how to make bread. You get the idea, right? Except we're talking proteins here. Now the problem is, not the problem, the challenge is, that the DNA material that sits in the nucleus can't leave the nucleus. So we've got genetic material in the nucleus in the form of the spaghetti and the pieces of spaghetti that represent the genes, but that can never leave the nucleus. We don't want it to. It's too important a compound, and we don't want it to be out in the inside of the cell getting banged around and disrupted, because that could lead to mutated proteins. So how the hell do we get the recipe from inside the nucleus outside to where we make proteins? We photocopy it. So the RNA takes a copy of the gene, and it's the RNA that needs the nucleus to go and make the protein. Yes, well, eventually. All three get used in the process. The messenger RNA. So, let's have a look here. We've got some DNA here, okay? And I'm not even going to use the slides because we're going back to slides next week. So I'll just give you the Brian version. Okay. So, what do we say in DNA? A-G-T-C. Okay. So you guys tell me the other letters. What are they? So this would be T. D. Okay, that's DNA, right? So because they always match up this way, and we said we have a hydrogen bond here, correct? Okay, so we've got this DNA sort of set up this way. Okay, we've got DNA. That's a gene. So that's going to make us a protein right there. Okay, a small one, but it's going to make us a protein. Have I got enough here? What have I got? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Perfect. So we've got three codons for amino acids. So this will make us three amino acids, which is going to give us a protein. So that's the recipe. It's in the nucleus. it can't leave the nucleus. Everybody follow me so far? So we need to make a copy of it. Here's the challenge. The way it sits right now, you can't copy it. The hydrogen bonds have the DNA connected, and it's not readable. So RNA has something called RNA polymerase. And what it does is it breaks the hydrogen bonds. And in doing so, exposes both sides of the DNA. Then the RNA reads those three codons and creates its own strand of RNA. But there's something different that has to happen. So let's just say we've split it. Okay, it's split. So I'm going to remove this side. It won't remove it, but we just got to get it out of the way. It's going to be over here somewhere because the polymerase has split it, yes? Okay, everybody follow me so far? Okay, so what does the RNA strand, what's it going to be? No.
You.
T and. Good. Correct. So this is the copy, and that's the RNA that leaves the nucleus to go outside to build the protein. Okay, so the RNA splits it and creates its own strand, which is a copy of the gene of the DNA. So the DNA never leaves the nucleus, only the RNA. So this RNA then, we've got a big pore here in the nuclear envelope. This floats around, exits the pore to go out and say hello to a ribosome to start to create the protein. Does everybody? It is a photocopy. It's a copy. It's not encrypted. It's a copy. It's just that ribosome, or that RNA, uses U instead of T, okay? But it's still a copy. So those three codons, right, they represent a particular protein. So these three will represent one kind of amino acid. These three will represent another kind of amino acid. And these three will represent a third kind of amino acid. And those three amino acids, when they come together and get bound by a ribosome, we have a protein. Yes, no, maybe. So just remember the key things here. One, DNA never leaves the nucleus. Two, DNA has segments of genes which represent particular proteins. Three, every three bases represents an amino acid to create said protein. Four, the DNA cannot leave the nucleus. It's the RNA that takes a copy, and it's the RNA that leaves the nucleus to have the protein created. So proteins are created outside the nucleus, in either free-floating ribosomes or those ribosomes that are connected to the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Yes?
Are you going to talk to us about how it changes from the messenger RNA to...
We're doing the whole thing. It doesn't change. No. Does that make sense? Yeah? We're 5-2. I'd love to continue, but we can't. Just understand those key points right now. DNA inside the nucleus. DNA has the recipes for proteins. And RNA takes a copy of the DNA to leave via the nuclear envelope to get to ribosomes to create the protein. Yeah, there's videos on here. Pretty sure they're still here. I think they are. They're still there, right? There's some really good videos I put on there that will help you. And there are tons of videos on YouTube you can watch. But there's also, if I remember correctly, I put a Khan Academy on there, which is quite good. That helps you along as well. And we'll discuss it a lot more next week for sure. Okay, this is in preparation for getting your heads wrapped around the Krebs cycle and the electron transport chains. Sorry, just up to I might not. I'll do a bit on here, but not too much, because we still need to get through some of the other things to understand it all. Okay. All right. See you guys next week. Hard to believe that this is week 4 of 14.